Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. The latest on shares, markets and investments. Now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Hello and welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Now also available on the UK Investor Magazine mobile app. For today's podcast, we're going to be taking a deep dive into the rights and issues investment trust. We're going to be looking at their approach to the UK small and mid-cap markets. We're going to be delving down into their strategy, as well as looking at some of their portfolio holdings. And to do that, we're very kindly joined today by Matt Cable, who is the fund manager of the Rights and Issues Investment Trust. Matt, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
My pleasure, and thanks for having me.
So really looking forward to this conversation. It's a fascinating area of the market, and you've got some really interesting holdings within the portfolio, which we're going to be looking at a little bit later in the podcast. But for those people that maybe aren't aware of the investment trust, Matt, please could we start with an introduction, first of all, to yourself as well as the Rights and Issues Trust, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name's Matt Cable. I'm lead manager of Jupiter Rights and Issues Investment Trust. I've been involved with running the trust for about 3 years now, since Jupiter took it on. We took it on from a chap called Simon Knott, who had run it pretty much single-handedly for 39 years very successfully, but sort of brought it into more of a corporate home and a professionalized platform that we have here at Jupiter. And I've been lead manager on the trust now for about 15 months. Rights and Issues is one of the UK's real venerable UK-focused investment trusts. As I say, the previous manager goes back 40-odd years, and the trust was founded before that. It's very much a UK smaller companies focused portfolio, and has a heritage which is really all around a concentrated portfolio. So we still run it today with sort of 20 to 25 holdings, very much a focus on quality and long-term holdings. So it's low turnover and taking perhaps a longer term view than most people would in the market these days. And essentially what we've done is taken that heritage and applied our team investment process to it, which really is around looking for high quality companies and attractive valuation entry points. So specifically, our process is focused around looking at the fundamental characteristics of companies that allow them to grow. So we look for companies which operate with high barriers to entry in growing markets, with attractive sort of return and margin characteristics. And then ideally, what we're looking for is those sort of interesting valuation entry points that allow you to get into great companies at a good price. And as I say, we then take a very long-term perspective on our holdings. Some of the holdings that we have today have been there for, you know, decades. It's that kind of mindset.
Indeed. And we're going to be discussing some of those holdings a little bit later on in the podcast. But one thing that I noticed, Matt, when I was preparing for this podcast, is you say that the trust is style agnostic, which is something I want to get into now. You know, first of all, what does that mean? And also, what does that mean in practice when you're managing the portfolio? And how does that impact your stock selection processes?
Yeah, so when we talk about being style agnostic, what we're really talking about is that sort of growth value axis and having no sort of preconceived ideas about where any individual holding is going to be on there. It's fair to say that team's process recognises to a certain extent that the market will go through different phases where a style will lead the market, and we're pragmatic enough that when that exists, we will allow to a certain extent a tilt to exist there. But generally speaking, through a cycle, we'll aim to be pretty balanced. And certainly where we are today, where we don't think there's significant market leadership, will be pretty neutral. To be clear, this portfolio in particular, we are looking for sort of a balance towards quality, because we do think that, you know, if you're going to invest for the long term, I mean, it sounds obvious that you want to own high quality businesses, strong businesses with those sort of attractive long-term growth characteristics. So that balance on the value growth sort of continuum, and to come back to your point of what does it mean in practice, we don't sort of set out to build portfolios as a team that work one way or the other. So we don't spend our days looking for another value stock because we think we're a bit underweight value. But what we do look at is the output. So we will pay attention to, is the portfolio becoming a bit value oriented or growth oriented? And unless that's something we've set out to do, we'll try and pull it back towards the centre. And it's a philosophy that we apply across actually a whole range of dimensions and themes. So again, we don't really set out to build a portfolio to a particular style, but we'll pay quite a lot of attention to how the portfolio looks from a style or a thematic perspective, and ask the question, is that deliberate? And if it's not, we'll look through position weightings to pull it back towards a more neutral position, unless it's something that we're deliberately setting out to do. But as a very sort of bottom-up process, typically we're not looking to generate large tilts or exposures towards individual styles, other than, as I say, quality, if you see that as a style, because we are trying to own good businesses that we can be comfortable with holding for a long period.
That's actually a really interesting point. Now, you say that you're neutral at the moment between the value and growth side of things. And you know, a little bit later on the podcast, I will ask around sectors and themes that you're looking at, because I think that will be something that's quite interesting for investors and really builds on the points that you've made there, Matt. But I would like to start, because of course you're UK focused, UK small and mid cap, and you're operating in a market which is offering deep value and has been offering deep value, which predominantly is being driven by the state of the UK economy at this point in time. So before we drill further down into the portfolio, start looking at specific sectors, themes and stocks, I would like to get your views on the UK economy and how you view it at this point in time and where you see opportunities for your particular strategy, but also risks for your strategy as well.
Yeah, and look, this is obviously a subject that we get asked about a lot. I mean, in a funny sort of way, of course, being UK small and mid cap managers, this is what we do. So I don't spend a huge amount of time worrying about it because this is the part of the market that we're focused on. But obviously we spend a lot of time thinking about the UK and indeed talking to companies about the UK. And it's interesting, as you say, there's a huge amount of negativity in the UK at the moment. And, you know, slightly personal view, but as a country, we've slightly sort of lost our confidence. And you can really see that in, you know, debates around the economy and, you know, what the government needs to do and all the rest of it. And I am very conscious that that mindset can have real world effects, that, you know, confidence is an important factor in growth and in the health of the economy. And that, if anything, feels like the biggest risk to the UK more broadly at the moment, is that we convince ourselves that we're not good at anything anymore and the economy is doomed and you know, and then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think trying to be more objective and standing back, a lot of the macro factors that one might consider when looking at an economy, so particularly around inflation, around rates, around growth, are actually okay and you know, not super exciting. And we have to accept that we are a developed market with an aging population and all those things. But actually, there's still a lot of dynamism in the UK. We still produce some great companies here. We make lots of good things. We have fantastic education sector, fantastic corporate governance and rule of law and all those good things, which actually, if you sort of, you know, had a blank sheet of paper and took the name off the top, you'd say this is an economy that looks in pretty good shape in the developed world. And I think that's really reflected, as I say, when I talk to companies, that nobody's under any illusions. There are challenges out there, but actually very rarely meet a management team who've got their head in their hands and say, you know, I can't run a business in the UK anymore. Most of them are saying there are challenges to navigate. Just had to pay a load more extra employer national insurance contributions, and now we've got to find a way to absorb that or pass it on or whatever the case may be. But actually, most of them are very much getting on with it, and there are lots of success stories out there as well. And I think sometimes that gets lost in just the sort of general misery around what might be coming in the budget. So, you know, when I think about opportunities, it's very much about getting change in mindset in the UK and a more significant degree of positivity. And then I think you could really see a change of direction in how people perceive UK business and UK equities. I think the government needs to lead that. I think the upcoming budget is going to be a really interesting sort of clearing event. There's no denying the fiscal situation that we're in. And something's going to have to give there, probably a bit on spending and probably something on tax, which in and of itself won't be super welcome. But I think actually, if we can get through that, and if businesses and consumers can say, do you know what, actually, I'm kind of okay, that we'll still see the whole country getting sort of back onto the front foot. And I think given the starting point, the degree of negativity, that could be really interesting. And you see that in businesses, because most UK businesses, and of course, the UK stock market isn't just the UK, and a number of our businesses are much more global than that. But when you talk to the more UK focused businesses, they're all very much trying to stay on the front foot. You know, people are not retrenching, people don't want to reduce capacity. Because they do see that opportunity for when things come back.
Indeed. The point that you make there, going into this budget and looking at sentiment near rock bottom, it doesn't take a lot for that sentiment to improve and actually have quite an impact on the market. So that's a really interesting point that you made there. But talking around confidence, Matt, we've seen, and this may be viewed as a barometer, and I'd be interested to see whether you see it as a barometer for confidence in the UK market. We have seen a spate of IPOs and companies signalling their intention to list. Is that encouraging for you? Do you feel that it should be viewed as a barometer of confidence in the UK market?
Absolutely. And I think in two senses, both that it reflects broader confidence in the UK economy from the corporates themselves and from the sponsors and sellers of these businesses. But it also just gives some reassurance that the UK market always historically has had a decent level of turnover. So businesses being bid for and taken off the market and then being replaced through IPOs. And that has felt over the last, two, three, 4 years that it's become a bit of a one-way process. And we've seen an awful lot of companies that have been bid for and taken over, and Rights and Issues has had its fair share. And while that is it's a great sugar rush on the day when you get a nice premium and you feel like you've made some money, it obviously, in the long run, takes out the vitality of the UK market. And so you do need companies coming back the other way and listing. So I think that's right, that actually now having few signs that this is coming back, and it is early days, don't get me wrong, but a few signs that things are coming back is really encouraging. And it's also encouraging just to get the feedback from the sell side, the brokers, the investment bankers. A lot of these things are being very well received. They're doing lots of meetings, lots of interest. And it does tell you that there is capital out there for good businesses at the right price. This process still works, both for IPOs and for companies raising money sort of later on in their lives, which we've also seen a little bit more recently. So, yeah, I think that's quite exciting. It's exciting because it tells you how people are thinking about the UK, as much as because sort of a handful of listings are going to make that much of a difference to the market yet, but hopefully that will be coming.
Indeed. You mentioned there are secondaries out there in the capital raising. That's also an encouraging point in time in terms of those companies being able to raise money at fairly decent levels in the market as well. So that adds to that positive sentiment around IPO. So back to Rights and Issues now, Matt. You touched on themes earlier on in the podcast. That's something I'd like to discuss now, because that would really be helpful in terms of where you're looking at the moment and seeing opportunities. Of course, your balance at the moment, as you say, between value and growth. So I think to really build that picture of where you see opportunities is to actually drill down some of the themes and whether indeed you pay too much attention to themes and sectors, or you really truly bottom up in your approach and really go on a stock specific basis?
Yeah, so it's very much a bottom up process. So that's always the starting point. The trust's history has been very much focused on industrial. So 3 years ago when we took it over, it would have been 2/3 of the portfolio, something like that. And we have been looking to make it more balanced. So we've got stronger weights today in sectors like tech, financials. So trying to bring a bit more sort of sector balance to it. There are still some areas that are pretty unlikely as holdings. So just by nature of our investment process, we tend not to own things where the outcome is mainly driven by something that we don't feel we have any edge in forecasting. And the obvious example would be resources. So we're very unlikely to own an oil exploration company or oil production company, because 90% of the outcome there is really just what the oil price does. And we're never going to outforecast the market on where the oil price is going. So we don't tend to own resource companies, energy companies. And we also tend not to own things where you've got sort of structurally low returns. So real estate would be a good example. There's nothing wrong with real estate as an investment, but it's clearly sort of on the risk reward spectrum. It sits at the lower risk, lower reward end of the spectrum, and that isn't what we're trying to do with an equity focused portfolio. But if you take those things out and accept that the journey has come from a very industrials focused portfolio, that's kind of where we are today. So we don't worry too much about precise sector weights, partly because actually, to a certain extent, especially in small cap sectors, don't always tell you about the underlying exposures that you're getting. What we do spend quite a lot of time doing is trying to understand where a thematic might be creeping in that perhaps we haven't fully appreciated. So for example, do we want to be long or short the relationship between the US and China? Well, not being a geopolitical expert, I probably don't want to be either. So we will look at the portfolio and say, are there some stocks here that could be particularly affected by that relationship in either direction? And if we feel that we've got a large concentration, a large exposure there, we might look to try to neutralize that to a certain extent. So it's a lot of, and some of this is art rather than science, it's a lot of trying to keep the portfolio in a reasonable degree of thematic balance so that what really comes through is the stock picking.
Thank you, Matt. So I'd like to move on now and discuss recent activity within the portfolio and touch on something that you outlined earlier. And of course, that's a number of holdings that you have in the portfolio, a high conviction portfolio, highly concentrated with around 20 to 25 holdings. So it may actually be the case that you haven't been buying or selling anything recently, but it'd be good to get your perspective on the approach to the concentration of the portfolio, as well as anything that you've been picking up recently.
Yeah, sure. Actually, almost as luck would have it, this is a good time to be talking about new holdings, partly coming back to this point about UK companies being bid for, because over the course of this year, we've had two quite large positions be bid for and taken over in Reynolds, the industrial chain company, and Alpha Group, which is an FX and payments business. And both of those have been taken over this year, which has meant, obviously, that sort of forces a degree of turnover in the portfolio. So there are some new holdings to talk about. But just briefly on the overall structure of the portfolio, again, going back to when we took it over 3 years ago, similar number of holdings, so sort of early 20s number of holdings, but was extremely concentrated in the top few holdings. So it was almost a sort of 6 or 7 stock portfolio, and then with a bit of a tail, and it was only really those 6 or 7 stocks that drove performance. And what has changed since then, so over the last 3 years, is that although it's the same number of stocks, they're now in a much more balanced, flat portfolio structure, if that makes sense. So the difference between the largest and the 20th largest holding is nowhere near as big. And what that means is that it's still high conviction. It's still, 23 of our very best ideas, but they should all contribute. And we don't have sort of capital tied up in little tiny things, which are never going to make a difference. But as I say, we have had some holdings to replace this year. So we've got a couple of recent new holdings, which I think do illustrate, or hopefully illustrate, some of the thought process that we're trying to apply here. So the first I'll talk about is Ashtead Technology. And this is it's a marine services business, and it serves both the traditional hydrocarbon-based energy producers, oil and gas companies, but also has a growing portion of its business in renewables, so particularly offshore wind. And it delivers a range of services, everything from enormous 800-ton winches to underwater robots and a whole load of kit that sort of would sit in between on the technology spectrum. And the common theme and the way it goes to market is effectively there's always some kit, some equipment in their sales. So it looks a bit like a rental company, but in fact, actually, is very much a high-tech services business. And you can see that because if you look at it on a tangible asset basis, so ignoring intangible assets that have come with acquisitions, it generates a return on capital of something like 50%. So nothing that you would see in a high street rental type business. And that demonstrates both the quality of the business and illustrates that point that it's very much a service business. Has an excellent track record of both organic and acquisitive growth, and has actually operationally performed really well since IPO a few years ago. So all of that we really like about the business, and we hold it elsewhere on some open-ended funds. Over the last year or so, though, the shares have derated very significantly. The valuation has fallen. And there are a few things that are behind that. So one of which is sort of a fair observation that it's had a slightly tricky year with Mr. Trump in the White House, his tariffs. And there's been one very small corner of their business that's been tangibly affected, which is US offshore wind, for sort of obvious Trump-based reasons. But that was only ever worth about 3% of the business, so pretty much in the roundings. At the same time, there's been some volatility and a bit of weakness in the oil price, which at the margin is relevant to them, but is much less significant than I think most people would appreciate, because they don't do a lot for oil explorers. So this is not really about greenfield oil. This is about maintaining existing assets, and actually an increasing part of it is decommissioning, which clearly is sort of counter-cyclical with greenfield oil. And then perhaps the most interesting thing that's been happening with them is that they moved the listing of the shares from AIM to the London Main Market, which has created a lot of disruption. Probably won't start now in all the ins and outs of inheritance tax, what that's meant for AIM shares, but it's definitely meant an awful lot of turnover in the shareholder register. And if I take all of those drivers of share price volatility and derating, really that all looks quite temporary to me. Now, temporary clearly is a relative term, and there are plenty of people in the market these days who would say, well, on a 6-month view, who knows whether all of that unravels, and on a 6-month view, I'm not interested. But when you're investing on a 5-year, 10-year view, that starts to look like a really attractive valuation entry point. And so this absolutely fits that profile of what I think is a really high quality business at a really attractive valuation entry point, accepting that you're never going to get these things exactly right. Worth just pointing out again that this is, while the business is based in Aberdeen, this is very much a global business. They're serving customers all around the world. And the other one I'll talk about is again, is a global business. I mean, actually, their UK business is almost irrelevant. This is Keller, and they are a groundworks contractor, be the world's largest independent groundworks contractor. And that's everything from foundations for large buildings to big civil projects, bridges, tunnels, that sort of thing, to reinforced concrete structures, sort of high-rise buildings, that kind of thing. And Keller's been around a long time, and it's had its ups and downs, a bit of a mixed history. And going back, I don't know, maybe 10 years, it had a phase of being probably over-expanding, some poor acquisitions and not being particularly well run. But over the last 5 years, under a different management team, has been really sorted out and actually now makes some very attractive returns, which is, again, sort of starts to hit some of the things that we're looking for in terms of quality. I mean, it's fair to say that this is being involved in construction, this is always going to have a degree of cyclicality. And I think that what we're seeing at the moment is that the equity market is very worried about a downturn in the US, which is where it's just the balance of their business is inevitably as a global business. And again, we've seen a sort of significant derating of the shares. So they're on a, for those who look at it this way, a forward price earnings ratio of about 7. What's really changed at Keller, though, which I think is less well appreciated by the market, is that they have now paid down almost all their debt. By the end of this year, they will be roughly debt free. And it's a hugely cash generative business. So I was just looking before the meeting at a broker note where they're forecasting a 14% free cash flow yield for the company. And what that means is that they can do something which we're seeing more and more companies do at the moment, which is buy back their own shares. So they can absolutely invest in the business organically. They can do M&A if they can find great opportunities. Or, and this is the lowest risk way of driving a, for any company to drive their earnings, they can go out and buy their own shares, and they can do so in a very safe way, given that the balance sheet is in such good shape. So, and because they're so lowly rated, as I say, this sort of forward PE of 7x, it generates a huge amount of value every time you buy your shares. Your shares themselves have an exceptional return on investment. So I think through the cycle and over time, Keller will once again deliver some quite attractive growth at very high returns. But the great thing here is that even if we do see a down cycle, and as I say, it's not my area of expertise to try and call these cycles, even if we did see a down cycle, they've got a way to grow earnings, to generate shareholder value by deploying their balance sheet.
So one thing we haven't discussed so far, Matt, is the dividend. And the trust actually yields around 3%. That's a fairly respectable dividend. But my question is, you know, whether you go out and actively seek high-yielding companies or companies that are paying a fairly reasonable dividend, or is it a case that you achieve this dividend as a byproduct of seeking out high-quality companies?
So my philosophy on dividends is that they need to be part of a company, a clear capital allocation strategy. So they're never an end in their own right from my perspective. So I'm not looking for companies that are generating a certain level of income. We do tend to think that it's a good marker of having got the balance of the portfolio right if we're generating a reasonable yield, and the trust itself pays a dividend, and philosophy is that we will try to maintain or grow that. But at the individual company level, it's not an income strategy per se. But I think what it does do is it demonstrates the right mindset in the management team that says, if we have opportunities to deploy our capital in a way that generates, you know, returns above the cost of capital, that's great, and be that through organic investment, through M&A, appropriately risk adjusted. And as I say, today for a lot of companies, I'm afraid, you know, buying their own shares is a good way to generate returns. But beyond that, that capital then shouldn't just sit on balance sheets, and the right discipline is then to return it to shareholders. And so if that's coming through a dividend, that's the right way to think about it. And, you know, and ultimately, the only long-term way to value equity is through the cash flows it generates, i.e. through its through a dividend stream. So it's an important part of our thought process, but we're not going out to look for dividend payers per se.
Thank you, Matt. So just picking up on Ashtead Technology, looking at the chart, it does suggest that there's some deep value there. But of course, you'll be drilling a lot deeper than that into the company. But the question that I have here is, when you're analysing a company such as Ashtead, which is relatively unique, there don't seem to be any direct peers here in the UK. What do you set out to do? Do you look at the wider UK benchmark as a gauge of valuation? Or is it a case that you may be looking overseas to really get a sense of the value of companies like this?
I think valuation is always a bit of a case of triangulation. And there's ultimately a bit of an art to it as well as science. So, you know, I think overseas peers sometimes give you some sense of where things should trade. But I'm always a little bit wary of that because, you know, as we know, for whatever reason, particularly with the US, we've seen, you know, some pretty significant valuation disparities open up. And so simply owning something on the basis that a US peer is more highly rated is probably not a way to make money. And you sometimes see that at the micro level as well within a sector. So, you know, European peers may well trade at a different level. But it gives you some sense, I suppose, where the market might be. And I think, you know, you can look at perhaps similar businesses that perhaps are in a slightly different sector, slightly part, different part of the market, but have similar financial characteristics. And again, that's a bit of a way of looking at it. But I think, you know, also I will go back to fundamental approaches to valuation. So for a relatively asset intense business, and actually, as I said earlier, Ashtead, funnily enough, isn't that asset intense, but you know, people might want to look at it as more of an asset balance sheet type business. And then you can start to look at sort of multiples of book value relative to returns. And you sort of triangulate it in different ways, you know, as well as company's own history. I do think what you're really looking for is those situations where almost whichever way you look at it, it's a struggle to make the valuation make sense. And that's where it starts to look really interesting. Because the reality is, of course, the way the market works is that it will value things based on the narrative and the sentiment around the individual stock or the sector to suit itself. So we've seen plenty of this in the UK, that coming out of COVID, anything that was technology exposed and e-commerce exposed, you'd stick everything on a price to, or an EV to sales type multiple, and away you went. Of course, as soon as that theme changed and the narrative changed, all of a sudden these things were being valued on a B multiple, and sort of banging your head against the wall and saying, well, actually, it should be on an EV to sales of blah is pointless. So you do have to bring in the degree of pragmatism. But if you can find a situation where you say, well, whichever way I approach this, whichever set of peers I look at, whichever valuation methodology I use, I kind of come to the same answer. That's when I think it's most interesting as an entry point.
Thank you, Matt. And I would note to listeners, if you'd like to know a little bit more about the Rights and Issues Investment Trust, do check out their page on the UK Investor Magazine Investment Trust Centre. There'll be a link through to that in the description of this podcast. So to finish up now, Matt, it's been a very comprehensive conversation. Thank you very much. Just looking now to get your broad perspective on the UK market. So as a UK focused manager, what would you say excites you the most looking forward from this point in time?
Do you know, it takes a certain amount of resilience to be a UK smaller companies for manager at the moment. And it's been a tough few years, and the flow data for our sector will tell you that. But weirdly, in a sense, that's what gives me grounds for excitement, is that the degree of negativity and pessimism around the UK and around our stock market has got to a point where just a relatively small shift in sentiment is going to make this a really exciting area to make money. And look, whether that's the next 6 months or the next year, or whether we're going to have to wait another 3 years, I don't know. You know, this is not a place to be attempting to make money from short-term trades. But if you can take a long-term perspective, which I do through Rights and Issues, but also, you know, my own investments, then this just looks like a great opportunity to me. And as I say, that probably doesn't feel apparent unless you spend time talking to UK companies and hearing their stories and seeing the opportunities that they see. That just feels totally incongruous with the broader negativity around the economy and the market. So if I can say I'm long-term excited, but you know, I appreciate that in the short term, I'm still having to grit my teeth fairly significantly.
That's a really interesting point that you make there, Matt, about getting out and speaking to companies, because often there is a chasm between what they're actually doing on the ground and the market pricing that they're currently experiencing. And that's, of course, where the opportunity sits for investors, especially those with a long-term horizon. Thank you very much for making that point. Just as a final note to listeners, if you'd like to know more about the Rights and Issues Investment Trust, do check out the notes to this podcast, because there'll be a link through to their page on the UK Investor Magazine Investment Trust Centre. So Matt, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you very much to everyone for listening. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember, all investment involves risk.